is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bill Roggio, the senior fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and his colleague Tom Joslin and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, the story of the battle over many decades now with the Islamists, the jihadists, from the Hindu Kush to the Mediterranean. We begin with a report out of Europe, however, that points to the crisis that is Afghanistan, the tragedy that is imminent. BBC headline, Afghanistan facing desperate food crisis, UN warns. Millions of Afghans, writes the BBC, will face starvation this winter unless urgent action is taken. According to the UN World Food Program, more than half the population, about 22.8 million people, face acute food insecurity, while 3.2 million children under five could suffer acute malnutrition. David Beasley, the executive director of the UN World Food Program, comments, Afghanistan is now among the world's worst humanitarian crisis, if not the worst. We are on a countdown to catastrophe. I begin there because the news out of Afghanistan doesn't strengthen, doesn't improve. We need to cite now that this isn't war fighting anymore. This is famine in the midst of plenty. The Silk Road and Iran and India, Pakistan, and China all talking about dealing with the Taliban. And before them are, according to the UN now, more than 3 million children who face food insecurity. I add to this the puzzles about the Afghan evacuees who have traveled out of Afghanistan, some of whom are now being detained by the U.S. in Kosovo, in Europe. But we'll turn to the grown-ups after we deal with food insecurity. Bill, a very good day to you. I want to start with the food insecurity because this was always in front of us. I congratulate the BBC for featuring it as the Afghanistan story. To your knowledge, was this ever a part of the conversation over many years about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, that the U.S. taxpayer was providing food for half the nation and 3 million children? Was that part of a conversation about what happens next? Good day to you, Bill.
Hello, John, and good day. And yes, this was sort of one of the elephants in the Afghan room. Everyone knew that about 40% of Afghanistan's economy was coming through foreign funding, through foreign aid. And of course, that includes food and other, a lot of the salaries paid for civil servants and teachers and whatnot in Afghanistan. So everyone knew this. And, you know, this is tragic, what's happening here. And the Taliban bears responsibility for this, John. They took control of this country, but, were prepared to govern from a force standpoint, but not from an actual governance standpoint. And that by that, it never had a plan of how was it going to feed the people and how was it going to keep institutions on their feet. But the Taliban really don't care about that. They just care about ruling, about imposing its version of Sharia or Islamic law. And that's where we are today. It's, and the Afghan people are going to suffer from this because I'm going to say something controversial here, but the U.S. was spent a lot of money. You know, we've heard estimates up to $2 trillion. I think that's high, super inflated, but let's say it was $1 trillion over the last 20 years. And everyone was eager to get out of Afghanistan. Now, why should the U.S. be eager to sink more taxpayer money into Afghanistan when it's being ruled by a terrorist regime? If China and Pakistan and Russia and Iran want to recognize a Taliban-controlled Afghan government, then let them fund it. Let them provide the aid to feed the people. This is not in the United States' interest to prop up a terrorist regime that came to power via force and used terror as its prime tactic to do so.
The BBC reports more from the World Food Program from the UN. It is urgent that we act efficiently and effectively to speed up and scale up our delivery in Afghanistan before winter cuts off a large part of the country, with millions of people, farmers, women, young children, elderly, going hungry in freezing winter. They need everything, starting with cooking oil. For heaven's sakes, nothing has been preserved. Or, Bill, Everything was fine before. I wonder if it's been plundered by the Taliban. The puzzle here is not complete. Where is the aid that was there before the takeover, the sudden takeover in August? Where are the food stocks? Where is the cooking oil? We have here a report that yesterday, according to one informant for the UN, I saw a woman who was going through the rubbish bins at the local hotel collecting the leftover food. I asked her why she was doing so. She said she didn't have any other solution. She didn't have any other solution. She was trying to find food for her children. So we're going to, these are the beginnings of the stories. The question that you raise is, where is the Taliban government? They have a head of government now, right? They have cabinet positions. I don't see them quoted in this piece. And I'm going to presume that's what you mean by we have a Taliban that doesn't care to actually govern the country, just impose Sharia law on what? Dissent? On a small percentage of it? Certainly you don't intend to impose Sharia law on people who are starving. That would be impractical.
Oh, I wouldn't put that past the Taliban, John. They are certainly, you know, single-minded when it comes to this. To your question about where is the food, so when the country fell, it was estimated that they had about 1 to 2 months of food stocks. The food was constantly flowing in, usually via Pakistan, also secondarily through Iran. The Pakistanis inexplicably have shut the border down. I think a lot of this is due to prevent refugee flows. So, but a lot, you know, I've seen video of trucks just stacked up across the border that weren't able to cross into Afghanistan. And the same thing on the other side, right? So that trade isn't happening. The Taliban is too, they are, the only comments they have about this is they're blaming the United States for withholding. There's about $9 billion in funds that is U.S. taxpayer provided that was allotted to the Afghan government. That was mainly to do things like pay salaries and for the military, things of that nature for the Afghan government. But the U.S. is not going to release this money because it goes to the Taliban, and the Taliban is a terrorist organization. It's listed as a specially designated global terrorist organization. It has been since 9/11. And, you know, there's implications for the U.S. to release, legal implications if the U.S. was to release that money to the Taliban. But, I mean, I think morally it's just wrong. Again, let the Taliban go and prostrate themselves to the Chinese and to the Pakistanis and the Iranians and the Russians, and let's see just how giving and how kind these regimes are that were so eager to make the U.S. leave the country. There's implications for losing a war, and there's also implications for winning one. The Taliban, the implications for the Taliban is winning, is they now have to govern. And if they want to govern, they're going to have to do some things that is going to help them feed the people. They're going to have to reach out and beg and let them do it. But U.S. taxpayers, we've spent enough there. We should not be eager to get back into Afghanistan. And we should not, our taxpayer dollars should not be propping up a Taliban regime.
Another piece of the puzzle that is in front of us right now. This is the New York Times reporting. 2 months after the evacuation of 80,000 Afghans, most have cleared subsequent vetting, but there are several dozen, writes the Times, who have been red flagged despite having helped the United States during its war in Afghanistan because screenings uncovered apparent records of violent crimes or links to Islamist militants. They're being kept or they're being housed in Camp Bondsteel, a NATO base in Kosovo. This is part of that chaos of the exit. What can we look for in this several dozen? Are these jihadists? Are these bad actors? What is your presumption here, Bill?
Yeah, and you know, I think this belies the idea that the evacuation was immensely successful, or I believe, I forget what President Biden's term was, extraordinary success. The U.S. evacuated over 120,000 people from Afghanistan, but did it evacuate the right ones? Look, I know people on U.S. military bases, one near my home, who, I'll be very vague, who deal with this issue. and said that there's people, there's a lot of Afghans here on U.S. soil, on U.S. military bases, who they don't know who they are, who are still being vetted. So this isn't a problem that that it just exists with a couple of handful in a base in Kosovo or overseas. This is happening here in the United States. I suspect that a large number of those who are of concern are very likely have criminal issues, or the issues are more criminal related. But, you know, we don't know, but, you know, we don't know the true answer of how many were snuck through, you know, may have been Taliban sympathizers, Islamic State sympathizers. They might have been plants. We don't know that. We don't know the answer to that. And that is the risk. And I was for getting all the Afghans out who needed to get out. But I was a believer that it needed to be the right ones, not just anyone who wanted to leave. It wasn't an exodus. It was an evacuation of America, of personnel who have helped America and who were going to repay. And it had become something more than that. And this is the result. And there are very serious national security implications for not properly screening the Afghans who made it here on U.S. soil.
After Afghanistan, we're going to turn to the resignation of a very significant diplomatic voice these many decades, Zamal Khalilzad, who has now left the U.S. presence in negotiating with any part of the Taliban, either in Kabul or the Afghanistan contingent in exile or the Afghanistan contingent outside of the Middle East. This is CBS Eye on the World with Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I'm John Batchelor. Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's a senior fellow. He and his colleague Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, a chronicle of the enormous battlefield of the Ummah these many decades. We're concentrating on Afghanistan because of the tragedy for many years, but certainly the exit in August. And now we come to a man who has been part of the conversation for decades and for several administrations, Zalmay Khalilzad, who was special envoy for Afghanistan reconciliation, much mentioned by Bill and Tom as we discussed the Trump administration's negotiation in Qatar with the Taliban. Puzzling. But now we have this report. President Joe Biden's former Afghanistan envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, said, this is CNN reporting, he quit the administration because internal debates weren't rooted in events on the ground. The quote, "One reason I left the government is that the debate wasn't really as it should be, based on realities and facts of what happened, what was going on, and what our alternatives were." I'll leave it, Bill, because you and Tom over the years have educated me to understand that oft times in negotiations in Doha, or conversations in general, flying back and forth by diplomatic courier, weren't based in reality or what the facts on the ground. First of all, what was the significance of Khalilzad from the Bush administration to the Biden administration? What part did he play? How did he do it?
Yes, John, you read my mind there with talking about the reality. But Khalilzad has been a diplomat across multiple administrations. Under the Bush administration, he served as representative to the United Nations in Iraq. He served as ambassador in Iraq during the early days of the Iraq War. So he's a seasoned diplomat. I actually testified alongside him in Congress at the House Foreign Affairs in 2016. And he seemed like he understood Afghanistan and Pakistan. He said, his verbal testimony was so similar to mine that I actually had to change mine because I followed him. And he said, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are intricately linked and they won't break apart. And Pakistan is a state sponsor of terrorism that, supports the Afghan Taliban and such. And then within 2 years, he led negotiations and he turned around and said, Pakistan is our ally and we can trust them. And the Taliban is going to eject Al-Qaeda and will turn on them. Those two things, of course, are not true, are not rooted in reality. And Khalilzad, throughout this entire process, since taking over he served as what they called the U.S. I forget his name, the special representative for Afghanistan reconciliation. So he's in charge of negotiations with the Taliban. But in doing so, he sidelined the Afghan government. He negotiated directly with the Taliban. The Afghan government didn't have a voice. He got vague counterterrorism assurances from the Taliban that wasn't worth the ink that it was written on, that were used to write it. And nothing he did was rooted in reality. He pretended like the Taliban, this is probably the most egregious, that he pretended the Taliban was willing to negotiate directly with the Afghan government and share power. That, of course, was never true. The Taliban always had a maximalist strategy of taking control of Afghanistan, of reestablishing the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. And that is what happened here. Khalilzad should have been fired. He should not have had the opportunity to resign. But the reality is under this administration, no one will be held accountable for their actions, for the debacle that we witnessed over the summer. But that is what happens when you have a president that witnessed this that views what happened in Afghanistan as an extraordinary success and not an unmitigated failure.
Bill, was the Bush administration, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration, were they talking to the wrong people at the Taliban? Was there anybody calling himself Taliban that was credible as a negotiator?
I believe the Taliban negotiators, at least in the Doha, there was an instance back in, I want to say it was like 2009 or 2010. I don't think Khalilzad was related in this, where they paid off a guy who pretended to be Mullah Baradar, who was the guy that led negotiations in Doha. They paid him hundreds of thousands of American taxpayer dollars, and the guy was an imposter. Think about that. This is where Tom and I say we don't even understand. The U.S. government never really understand who it was negotiating with. But in the case here, I know the Taliban was using negotiations. We were negotiating with the right people. It's just that the Taliban used negotiations as a ruse. Negotiations for the Taliban was a means to get the U.S. to withdraw. The Taliban knew once the U.S. left, the Afghan government was a paper tiger and it would be able to go at them. And that is exactly what we witnessed this summer. So Khalilzad, the reason he is complicit in this is he should have known this. You knew this. I knew this. Tom knew this. I'm sure your listeners understood this after listening to what we've discussed on air over the years. But the U.S. government pretended that something else was happening. And that's why Khalilzad's talk about reality here is he owns that reality. And I want to point out one more
thing that he says. 30 seconds.
He says that the reasons are too complex to understand why talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government didn't go through. It's quite simple. The Taliban lied to Khalilzad, and Khalilzad and others believed it because they needed to and wanted to believe it.
Bill Rogel. He and Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. After Afghanistan, there are many questions to answer, and we're going to turn to one of them that is an ongoing puzzle even for the Taliban, the Islamic State. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Rogel of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He is a senior fellow. He and Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, a chronicle of the vast battlefield these many decades, from the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush, with the jihadists in all their iterations. And one of them, since 2014, known as the Islamic State, is represented in many battlefronts. We're going to concentrate right now on the reports of ISIS in Afghanistan. They were always here for these last years. They call themselves the Khorasan province. It's romantic of them to come up with a name that attaches to something in the past and the future. However, their actions are bloody-minded and very focused on undermining the credibility of the Taliban. I have a report from CBS in these last hours. On nearly every street corner, in every neighborhood in Afghanistan's capital, you'll find the Taliban. The militants are now the guardians of the city. While the Taliban's war with the U.S. may be over, the group faces another enemy called ISIS, ISIS-K. CBS News correspondent Tayyab and his team went for a ride with some of the Taliban fighters whose job it is to secure Kabul's streets. What goes on to present itself is that the Taliban is insecure in Kabul, in the capital city, having to do with what they regard as their enemy, ISIS. There have been bomb attacks these last weeks. Tom and Bill have reported on them, Jalalabad, Kunduz, and Kandahar, picking around different parts of the country. Bomb attacks that were associated with ISIS-K. The Taliban then communicates through its spokespeople that it is cracking down on the Taliban. It is making arrests. It is concentrating its forces, especially in Kabul, where there haven't been, to my knowledge, bomb attacks. But we have one other detail here, a twist. One of the suicide bombers, the attacks are at mosques, which is a concentration of Shia. So there's an excuse for the ISIS to think that they're attacking something that isn't the Pashtun, but a subset of Afghanistan, the Shia religionists. However, one of the suicide bombers was a Uyghur, or said to be a Uyghur. Remember, none of this is transparent. We don't have independent confirmation. Reuters is not being invited to the scene of the crime. So what we have is the statement by the Taliban that a Uyghur from Xinjiang, from westernmost China, was used in an attack at Kunduz. Bill, I come to you because increasingly this story is growing. Is it the media? Is it Europe? Is it the Taliban? Why is ISIS hanging around? And is there thinking anywhere that ISIS, like the Taliban, can hang on long enough to discomfort and then replace the regime? Because it regards the Taliban as nationalists.
John, the Islamic State Khorasan province, my assessment of it is it likely has thousands of fighters, but it currently controls no territory. I don't see any evidence or any indication that is threatening to control territory. And to me, that is the key indicator of how dangerous a group is. Right now, it can operate on the cellular level. We're not looking at an insurgency here. We're looking at a terrorist operation. Can it ramp up its activities? It's possible, but I estimate that it's unlikely. Again, the territorial issue matters and the state sponsorship issue matters. It doesn't have a state sponsor. There is no one who supports it, no government that supports the Islamic State. As bad as Pakistan and the Iranians are, they're not that crazy because the Islamic State isn't as pragmatic as groups like Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and other terrorist organizations that are willing to make deals in order to get what it needs. The Islamic State's way is my way or the highway. They will not work with states. This is the main criticism they have of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So without those key drivers for an insurgency, I just don't see the Islamic State doing more than breaking things and killing people. But that weakens the Taliban, absolutely. It makes them look weak. It makes things look insecure. But again, we're not looking at the Taliban. We're not looking like what we witnessed over the previous 20 years, where the Taliban had this insurgency that was growing and gathering territory and building and being able to field armies in a small way. The Islamic State's operating at a very different level. It's a dangerous level, but it's not one that I think threatens the Afghan Taliban's rule on the country.
And any evidence, Bill, of Al-Qaeda in Kabul? The denial by the Taliban dates back many months, if not years, but there's no reason anymore to continue to deny the obvious. Have they talked about it?
So I'll take a contrarian view. There's lots of evidence of Al-Qaeda in Kabul. And I'd say look no further than Sirajuddin Haqqani, who the United Nations this spring identified as an Al-Qaeda leader. Sirajuddin Haqqani, of course, is a deputy emir of the Taliban, and he's their interior minister, arguably the most powerful individual in the Taliban government. and the head of the Haqqani Network, of course. And it's so look at him and look at his underlings. There's other Taliban who are not Haqqanis who are closely linked to al-Qaeda, who the U.S. military used to describe as dual-hatted al-Qaeda Taliban leaders. These are leaders that commanded forces or operated as leaders within both groups. Now, if we're talking about core al-Qaeda, you know, with people, which I despise that term, al-Qaeda's senior leadership, we haven't seen evidence of that because they're operating clandestinely as they have in the past. Right after Kabul fell, and the Afghan government was deposed and the Taliban took control, we saw one or two instances of legacy al-Qaeda leaders returning to their homes with Taliban parades. But the Taliban clamped down on that, not meaning they didn't allow, I don't think that means they didn't allow al-Qaeda to return to their homes or do things like that. They just didn't stop publicizing it because it made them look bad. But I have no doubt that al-Qaeda is quite happy with what has transpired. I know because they've said so. And without a doubt, al-Qaeda leaders are filtering back into Afghanistan from both Pakistan and Iran because the country is now a safe haven for them.
Al-Qaeda, this is CNN reporting, your report at Longword Journal as well. An airstrike in northwest Syria Friday killed senior al-Qaeda leader Abdul Hamid al-Matar, according to U.S. Central Command. No indications of civilian casualties as a result of the strike, said U.S. CENTCOM, using an MQ-9 drone. Bill, there's nothing else attached to this, but it suggests that the U.S. policy, at least, remains using airstrikes, drone airstrikes against al-Qaeda leadership, operating throughout the area, throughout the Middle East. Is there any other way to interpret the claim of a senior al-Qaeda leader? I don't believe we've had a martyr tape yet.
No, and we probably won't, not for some time, if at all. A lot of times al-Qaeda has been just kept quiet about who their leadership is, where they've been killed. They used to celebrate these types of things years ago. Sometimes we may see it, we may not. I mean, who was Abdul Hamid al-Matar? We don't know. It's the first time I've seen his name. What was his position? You know, they call him a senior al-Qaeda leader. What was his position? Was he involved in external operations? Was he a field commander? Was he, you know? But to your point, this is how we're back to the 1990s. We're back to launching attacks via air against terrorist organizations. But this doesn't deny them the key, what they need to succeed. And that's safe haven. That's, controlling territory, being able to run training camps and being able to recruit and indoctrinate and all of the things that made, you know, the 9/11 Commission report is very clear about this. So we're basically back to, you know, playing whack-a-mole with al-Qaeda because the reality is, there's tens of thousands of al-Qaeda fighters in Syria, in Idlib province in Syria, which is a safe haven for them. And Abdul Hamid al-Matar will be replaced. Al-Qaeda has thousands upon thousands of veteran leaders. I'm just talking about leaders here that can be promoted to take his place. Will it hurt them? Maybe in the short term. Well, it might make life difficult for them. They have to consider dealing with things like, you know, personal security and operational security and things like that. But they've been dealing with this for the past 20 years. I mean, al-Qaeda's leadership supposedly was decimated in northwestern Pakistan. And yet al-Qaeda, as an organization, has only grown since 9/11, has opened up new branches and commands armies to wage insurgencies in multiple countries in Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia.
Bill Rajo for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Long War Journal. To Bill's point, there is a report by Caleb Weiss of the FTD. Al-Qaeda field commander reported killed in Mali, reported killed, a man who's said to have been part of the Group for Support of Islam and Muslims, which is acronym JNIM. This is a French operation. We don't know more than the fact that the French are claiming the kill. However, from Mali to Syria to Afghanistan, you understand al-Qaeda is busy recruiting with replaceable parts. Bill Raggio, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, keeping the long war journal. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.